that our people were not recognized as U.S. citizens. So why the hell would they give their lives to a country that didn't see them as people? They were still treated bad. So why? And it was a really simple answer. They said, because this is still home.
By now, it's well known that Native people join the military in greater numbers than any other ethnic group in the United States. Some say because it's a decent career path, especially given the discrimination that indigenous people still face in this country. Others say that it goes back to the boarding school era, which are run more like boot camps than educational institutions. But we say, because we know, that we join the military because we want to protect our land. This land has been our home before it became the United States, and will always and forever be Native land. Decoded is a production of Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means that we are funded by you, the listener. Today we consider the new BFI monograph on Wes Anderson's Rushmore. But first we get a double dose of Jeff Godsell's Essentials of Cinema, starting now with Ghost World.
A few minutes into Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World from 2001, and you can see that this is not a movie that's going to try too hard to win you over. I tend to like that. Movies like this tend to win me over, especially if they feature characters like Enid and Rebecca, two newly graduated high school friends whose sardonic and cutting humor alienates them from just about everybody but themselves. These are two girls who I definitely would have wanted to hang out with in high school. Based on Daniel Clowes' graphic novel and co-written by Clowes and director Zwigoff, Ghost World follows Enid and Rebecca, played by American Beauty's Thora Birch and 16-year-old Scarlett Johansson in her first major role, beginning with their graduation and the days that follow. Like modern-day Holden Caulfields, they survey and comment on the shallowness and vapidity of their unnamed suburban town. For Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, he was surrounded by phonies. For Enid and Rebecca, they're all just
jerks.
And it's hard to blame them when Zwigoff creates such a stinging and unfortunately familiar portrait of suburban life. The girls' barbs are not spared on each other either, which gives them a rather endearing quality. They are clearly best friends, and most likely their only friends, which is fine by them. Rebecca favors rather plain, non-trendy, I-don't-care clothes, while Enid shapeshifts with a new look and different hair almost daily. Creativity is never lacking with the girls as they find new ways to stave off the boredom of their perceived entrapment. Entertainment can come in the form of torturing others. Like answering a lovelorn's request in the back pages of the weekly magazine for a rendezvous. The girls set up the meeting in a cafe so they can sit and watch the poor victim, named Seymour, played by Steve Buscemi, sip his milkshake and wait for no one to arrive. A chance second meeting with the poor sap at a garage sale finds Enid surprisingly intrigued by the records that he's selling there. Eventually, something like a relationship actually develops between Enid and Seymour, much to Rebecca's chagrin. Meanwhile, the realities of life after high school begin encroaching on the girls. Rebecca succumbing to a job at a coffee shop, and Enid utterly unable to keep even the easiest of jobs, like at the concession stand at a movie theater in a particularly hilarious scene. Zweigoff never goes for big yucks in Ghost World, but gets them anyway, if you're in the right frame of mind. Enid has to take a summer art class, a makeup class, so that she can actually graduate. The teacher, an earnest, artsy, self-proclaimed performance artist, is delightfully played by Ileana Douglas, Melvin Douglas's granddaughter and Martin Scorsese's ex-girlfriend, among other things. She's also the woman who gets her face chewed off by Robert De Niro in Cape Fear. I highly recommend her memoir, I Blame Dennis Hopper, an account of growing up weird in the fringes of Hollywood. Kind of like Running with Scissors, but with lots of film references. Zweigoff keeps Ghost World running at a very easy, lived-in pace, almost belying the momentous events that are about to occur in the girls' lives. Nothing less than the future is facing them, and Enid has a particularly rough time. After a couple of days where nothing seems to go right, she makes some hard choices, and Ghost World ends in a particularly touching and enigmatic way. For a teen coming-of-age movie, Ghost World is a kind of anti-John Hughes movie, darker in its humor and way cooler. Everyone fits in their roles like a glove, and it's unimaginable that anyone other than Buscemi could be Seymour. As usual, Ghost World did less than stellar business on its release, but has steadily grown to become a favorite among legions. I recommend the Criterion Edition with great extras and two booklets, including a comic book by Klaus himself. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Next, Jeff takes on a tour of The Fog of War.
There are few documentary filmmakers whose names are as well known as some of their films. Early pioneers like Frederick Wiseman and the Maysles brothers became known for their controversial subject matters, but more for throwing out the narration and using just the filmed footage. It seemed more honest that way, less manipulated, closer to the truth. And that's what we want from a documentary, to get closer to the truth, don't we? But I think we've all come to realize that it's impossible to present a filmed document of anything, fictional or not, that's completely without manipulation, without any point of view. Morris's approach was often to simply let the subjects speak for themselves, as much as possible, but avoiding the talking head syndrome by providing as much supporting footage or graphics as needed. The subject is allowed to make their own case or dig their own graves, as in the case of the notorious scumbags like Donald Rumsfeld or Steve Bannon. And in the Oscar-winning documentary The Fog of War from 2003, the subject was Robert McNamara. While not a biography, some time is naturally spent on McNamara's early years, his schooling at Berkeley and the Harvard Business School, establishing that, if anything, McNamara is an intellectual, an academic, concerned with ethics and morality, would have been perfectly content remaining in the world of academia, where were he not recruited first into the business world by Henry Ford II at the Ford Motor Company, and then by President Kennedy to become Secretary of Defense. And as the title suggests, it is here where the focus of the film resides. McNamara was Secretary of Defense under both Kennedy and Johnson when the Vietnam War was begun and when it first escalated. Looking back at a war that is seen today as a disaster, a tragedy, and a blight on the nation's history, it is only natural that the viewer would expect the film to answer some hard questions, not just about McNamara, but others involved. Who wanted what? Who was making the decisions? And who can we blame? And would McNamara even be our best guide on this journey to find out? To understand McNamara's mindset, we begin with World War II. McNamara served for 3 years in the Air Force during the war, under General Curtis LeMay. In a remarkable turn of events, the two would butt heads years later. LeMay, even then, was controversial but effective in his campaign of relentless firebombing of Japanese cities. Between March and August of 1945, it is thought that the attacks killed more than 500,000 Japanese civilians and left 5 million homeless. All of this before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As McNamara states clearly in the film, only the losers in a war are accused of war crimes. If the U.S. had lost the war, we would surely have been found guilty. Looking back at Woodrow Wilson's hopeful belief that World War I would be the war that ended all wars, McNamara laments Wilson's failed attempt at establishing a true League of Nations. It's tempting to flash forward to McNamara's stint as Secretary of Defense in the 60s, but in The Fog of War, we first look at McNamara's recruitment to the failing Ford Motor Company. At first, it was easy to see what was wrong with the company. It was a mess. But to turn it around, it took someone to ask deeper questions, different questions. McNamara was a data man. He ordered studies, research projects. In other words, he believed in information, and he used it in his decision-making to make the Ford Motor Company a powerhouse, just as he would use information in his decisions in the government. Later, lawmakers in Congress would sometimes complain of McNamara's arrogance. When speaking before Congress, he appeared as someone who already had the answers. The fact is, he probably did. He said that for every hour of testimony before Congress, there was 3 hours of preparation. Sometimes the smartest guy in the room can just look like a know-it-all. When the newly elected President Kennedy approached the astonished McNamara with the offer of either Secretary of Treasury or Secretary of Defense, McNamara said that he didn't know anything about government. Kennedy replied, "Well, there's no guidebook for being a president either. We'll learn our jobs together." McNamara accepted the defense job. Abandoning his $3 million a year salary as CEO of Ford for a mere $25,000. It began a deep friendship with JFK and his brother Robert. McNamara became one of Kennedy's closest advisors on all matters. In The Fog of War, McNamara recalls how he chose the spot at Arlington Cemetery for Kennedy's burial, showed it to Jackie, who agreed. It's the most beautiful spot in D.C. In relating this in the film, the 85-year-old McNamara weeps. McNamara's first test of leadership in the Kennedy administration was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and his first butting of heads with Curtis LeMay. As chief of staff of the Air Force, LeMay wanted to bomb the missile sites and didn't care if all of Cuba was destroyed with them. Cooler heads prevailed, but McNamara does not credit rational thinking for the successful outcome of the crisis that brought us so close to a nuclear war. Khrushchev was rational. Castro was rational. Kennedy was rational, he says. Most everyone acts rationally in war, and still, they kill millions. As for the Cuban Missile Crisis, says McNamara in one of the most chilling conclusions, the deciding factor was luck. And then to the heart of the matter, Vietnam. In the middle of a conflict, McNamara says, it is impossible for either side to make all the right decisions, impossible to see all the facts, all the possibilities, obscured as they are by the fog of war. Sounds like an easy way out, doesn't it? A convenient way to explain away all the blunders, all the missteps, all the foolish rationalizations of a ridiculous war. To McNamara's credit, in the film, he uses hindsight to blow away a lot of that fog, with the admission that the U.S. and the North Vietnamese were fighting completely different wars, and with a stupefying lack of communication between the two sides. That understanding could never come. This despite the fact that the Vietnamese made it abundantly clear that their struggle was a civil war, a war for independence, and that they saw the U.S. as no different than the French before them, pushing their colonial interests in a country where they didn't belong. McNamara insists that that was never the U.S. intentions,
rather naively sidestepping the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had warned about years before. No, the great U.S. fear at the time was rooted in that great seductive lie, the domino theory. The idea that if the forces of democracy, that is the U.S., failed to keep their foothold in Vietnam, then one by one, other countries would fall. To the communists, to China. And the lie was reinforced by more lies. The supposed attack on U.S. ships that led to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. McNamara was able to see early on in the Kennedy administration that Vietnam was a quagmire and we ought to be looking for ways to get out. Director Morris uses newly released tape recordings of phone conversations between the two men to essentially verify McNamara's recollections, as he does later when McNamara tries persuading Johnson that escalation of the war is the wrong way to go. The portrait of McNamara that emerges in the fog of war is of a thinking man, but also of a feeling one. He believes that if Kennedy had not been assassinated, the war in Vietnam would never have escalated to the deadly level that it did. Stopping short of, say, the assertion that Oliver Stone makes in JFK that Kennedy had definite plans to end U.S. involvement. If there is a weakness to be found, it would have to be in McNamara's not pushing back harder against Johnson and the generals. But McNamara saw it as his duty to serve the president, to attempt to help him reach his objectives. Well, the relationship between the two men did eventually become untenable, and McNamara left office on February 29, 1968. He became head of the World Bank and held that position until his retirement in 1981 at 65. In an epilogue to the film, McNamara says he no longer has anything to say when asked about the war and his role in it. Far from hiding from it, he's published many books, including Argument Without End in Search of Answers to the Vietnam Tragedy, and In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. What more is there left for him to say? This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And now let's remember Wes Anderson's Rushmore with the help of the new British Film Institute monograph on the film. Famously, film writer David Thompson dismissed Wes Anderson in one short sentence. Thompson has a book called The Biographical Dictionary of Film, first published in 1975 and expanded and revised some six or seven times through two publishers. Each book had about 500 to, later, 1,300 entries of varying lengths, from a filmography in three or four paragraphs to several pages, depending on the stature of the subject, be they directors, producers, actors, or actresses. In the volume for 2002, nuzzled next to Paul Thomas Anderson, Mr. Thompson's entry reads in total, "Watch this space. What does that mean? That he might be something one day." Close quote. What the F, as they say? Why did Mr. Thompson abrogate his critical responsibility, as it were, to list the name but pose no opinion? Why waste the space, minimal as it was? Well, if you watch a different space, 24 years later, in 2024, with 13 additional films added to Wes Anderson's filmography, there are some 10 books on his career and counting. A few fewer on Paul Thomas Anderson so far, but also counting. Eventually, Mr. Thompson revisited Wes Anderson in the volume for 2012, two books or so later, and added these thoughts. Quote, "What I meant to say was that Wes Anderson seems to me enormously promising, if not yet clarified. If pushed further, I would have said that Rushmore was one of the best films about high school age kids. I liked it very much, but felt already that the Royal Tenenbaums had a kind of whimsical pretension that can mark and beguile a student who has given up on being educated. In the years since, the Wes Anderson cult built, along with the sense that he is central to the most valuable young generation America has brought to film in 30 years. So far, so good. Watch this space, close quote. Then in another updated version, he added this, quote, alas, the Life Aquatic and the Darjeeling Limited did not feel or occupy the space. They lost it. These are two pretty awful films, and I see no reason not to say that. I think the comparison with Paul Thomas Anderson is a signal. PTA's films have been odd and disconcerting at times, but overall they leave no doubt about the maker's sense of trying to make films in a time of immense physical and cultural crisis. By contrast, W.A. seems to exist at the far end of a very private, isolating corridor. Moonrise Kingdom seemed to exist on an island. It was pretty, whimsical, and consistent. But what was the point? Close quote. Mr. Thompson has provided us with a series of readably argumentative volumes in this series, but I don't understand the motivation here. But one comment he made in the foreword to his third edition evinced weariness, concluding that books are better than movies. His thoughts could be well echoed today as the working reviewer sees dozens of uniformed and uniform superhero movies, violent action comedies, video game adaptations, as well as soulful autobiographical anecdotes and thinly disguised political tracts. This weariness can be detected in the way he updates his articles. He rarely, if ever, completely rewrites them, but rather adds an addendum that seems illy jigsaw puzzled into the entry, displays minimal keeping up with the new movies, and sometimes doesn't notice that the subject of the entry has died in the interim. In 2012, Sight and Sound readers voted the Biographical Dictionary of Film the greatest movie book of all time. Kristen Irene McKim's 97-page monograph for the BFI is neither the first and surely not the last book on Wes Anderson. She focuses on Rushmore, but her thoughts, quote, and observations apply to films of that phase in his career, less so to the more ornate recent films, close quote. Professor McKim is professor of English Film and Media Studies at Hendrix College and is the author of Love in the Time of Cinema and Cinema as Weather, and her work has appeared in such publications as Senses of Cinema and Camera Obscura. As usual, this latest book in the BFI Film Classics series packs in a lot of information and observations, but I'll let her summarize the contents. Quote, Chapter 1 offers a brief artist history and a summary of criticism and scholarship. Chapter 2 takes up Rushmore's bravado, speed, and excess within montage sequences that compress time. And by the way, this is a section in which she charts the use of songs in the film, and it's one of the most valuable parts of the book. Continuing to quote, Chapter 3 counters the speed by attending to the grace and sensitivity that arise in moments of pause and slowness, in looks and gestures that elongate the film. Chapter 4 combines these temporal modes of speed and slowness to argue that Rushmore's legacy emerges less in its materiality than in the cinematic opening. Rushmore's exclusive lineage to new kinds of learning. Chapter 5 foregrounds this pedagogical concern with an explicit focus on teaching and education within Rushmore. While chronology structures chapters 1 through 3, the final two chapters approach Rushmore conceptually, easing textual pressure for a more porous reading experience. Close quote. And she goes on to summarize, quote, this book offers an urgent corrective to what might be perceived as an endearing portrait of exceptionalism entrenched in perpetuating a status quo power, marketed with the tagline, Love, Expulsion, Revolution. Rushmore reveals the quickness with which a schoolboy crush can escalate into assault, as it teaches us to see with tenderness the softening of such shrillness and exaggerated drive, the emotional resonance that includes but transcends character, therein becoming, through warmth and humor, a grander sight of learning for the audience beyond the film, close quote. She also reminds us that this is a book about Rushmore, not a book about Wes Anderson's entire output. She writes, quote, though glancingly referring to such history and context, this book appreciates Rushmore for its own sake, harnessing its vitality and force, its complexity and evocation. I situate Rushmore as a film for the 21st century, invested in hope and healing, in grief and finding light, in joy and community. This book, built from years of vibrant classroom discussion, reflects the polyvocality and mutual enlivening of teaching and learning, close quote. Well, as you can tell from the optipenultimate word in that last sentence, the author is prone to some flights of academic jargon that sometimes can tend to inhibit complete understanding, while also sometimes skewing the text towards ill-fitting associations with contemporary politics. For example, when discussing the montage sequence set to a song by The Who, she writes, quote, referring in title to fast and secret sex, a quick one invites nostalgia for any moment of hubris or foolishness when we thought ourselves triumphant, emergent, proud in our own skin, ennobled in the world, however naively. The pleasure of Max's play acting here is further a privilege of his whiteness, as innumerable black male teenagers have had their lives tragically cut short, not given the benefit of the doubt or a chance to learn relative to law enforcement or neighborhood watch, close quote. Depending on your perspective, this will either strike you as a gratifying addendum or an intrusive political insertion. But to show that considering the film is not at all a matter of numbers and history and themes and politics, she writes, quote, Rushmore thrills me for what film, not just this film, but any film or any good film can be, an energizing and multitudinous form that looks forward and backwards, that conjures vivacity, that restores life. It's a nice way to end the book. Well, there you have it, and thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, of course, keep watching the screens.
Summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walked by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I. Sweet, sleepy warmth of summer nights, gazing at the distant lights in the starry sky. They say that all good things must end someday. Autumn leaves must fall. But don't you know that it hurts me so to say goodbye to you? You didn't have to go. No, 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 no. And when
my window pane, I'll think of summer days again and dream of you. They say that all good things must end. Don't you know that it hurts me so to say goodbye to you? Wish you didn't have to go. No, 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 no. And when the rain beats against my window pane, I'll think of summer days again and dream of you. Dream of you.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Make sure to tune in on Wednesday, November 26th from 6 to 7 p.m. to vote for the president of the Youth Collective. We want this to be an unbiased, fair election, and that's why we need you to vote. But really, you should be biased. Biased to